like that kind of makes sense. You know, you have, if you have three people over here rioting and I'm standing around near the riot, I guess it kind of makes sense to tell the non-rioters that they have to leave so that they're not going to get in the way when you break up the riot or these other three people over here engaging in disorderly conduct. So that's what the ordinance is for. Well, here the protesters refused to disperse, and they were charged with violating this for not dispersing when they were told to in circumstances where three or more persons were committing acts of disorderly conduct. Now, the one slight problem here was nobody was engaging in disorderly conduct. You know, these recruiters, they'd seen it all a million times before. They're not going to start getting disorderly. And there was no evidence that anybody else was getting disorderly. So the fact, one of the elements of this offense was there have to be three other people being disorderly. Here, there were no other people being disorderly. The defendants in the criminal case, who later became the plaintiffs here, went to court, to state court. The judge kind of saw through it. The prosecutor asked, well, can we have a continuance? And so the judge said, no, you're not going to be able to prove your case. So the judge just dismissed the case, and there were no charges against them. Well, the plaintiffs, I guess emboldened by that victory, decided to go to the U.S. District Court and get an injunction against any further enforcement by the city of Chicago of this ordinance. And on First Amendment grounds, because really what this ordinance is kind of like a heckler's veto. So for example, if I come in here and give a speech and the three of you or three of you don't like what I have to say, you can start engaging in disorderly conduct and, you know, throwing tomatoes at me or whatever. It's not my fault that you're throwing the tomatoes, so whether or not that's disorderly, you should not have the right to shut down my speech. If I'm acting perfectly peaceably, you should not have the ability to have a veto and put my speech to an end just because you decide to act in a disorderly fashion. Well, that's kind of what this ordinance does. The police can tell you, under this ordinance, if I come in here, I'm giving a speech, and people start throwing tomatoes at me, the police can tell me to leave. It doesn't say that they have to arrest you. I suppose they could, but they don't have to. They can tell me to leave, and I can get arrested for doing nothing other than coming in and giving a speech. So that can give rise to a heckler's veto. And earlier Supreme Court cases make clear that there cannot be a heckler's veto, that hecklers should not be allowed to dictate what kind of speech I give. And that's kind of what happened here, except that there weren't any hecklers. But the city used an ordinance saying if there were hecklers. Well, the district court in Illinois granted the injunction, but the city appealed. And the Court of Appeals reversed, not because they said that that would be a proper heckler's veto, but because the plaintiffs in this case lacked standing, because they were not prosecuted under the statute. There was no heckler's veto here. They were prosecuted with violating the statute, but there was absolutely no grounds for that. I think the court used the word specious to describe the prosecution in the state court. Therefore, they lacked standing. The court said, such a clear misuse of a law. So there's a misuse of this law, does not provide a basis for a federal court to explore that law's facial constitutionality. So if these people had been convicted or threatened with conviction for violating it, if they actually had incited this disorderly conduct by other people, then yeah, they probably would have had standing. But here, they simply lacked standing. There was no case or controversy because this statute had not been enforced against them. The city purported to enforce it, but it was quickly dismissed when it was found that there was no factual basis for it. So they lacked standing. And they are not able to bring that charge. Although, it certainly seems to me that if they were arrested and charged for inciting disorderly conduct, if that's really what happened, if that really was what the facts were, then I think the district court would have been right in enjoining that. So I suspect we'll probably see that ordinance before the courts again. Well, moving from the shores of Lake Michigan to the shores of Lake Mendota, and that brings us to our second code word, Mendota, M-E-N-D-O-T-A. And the University of Wisconsin, case of Badger Catholic versus Walsh. Well, the University of Wisconsin, like most schools, collects student fees from the students for a wide variety of things to enhance the educational experience. One of the things that goes for is money going to various student organizations to bring in speakers and to do various programs to put on different programs for the students. And in the past, they've provided these funds for a wide variety of organizations. Sustainable agriculture, certainly important in an important agricultural state. Social justice, healthy sexuality, a wide variety of things. In fact, the rules were set up such that these funds could be used for pretty much any kind of speech except prayer, proselytizing, or religious instruction. Well, I don't know if they used these words, but it was pretty much beyond dispute. Badger Catholic, as the name implies, a student organization, a student religious organization made up of Catholic students, they applied for some funds. And again, I don't know if they used these words in their application, but it was pretty much undisputed that they were going to use the money for prayer, proselytizing, and religious instruction. And the student government said, nope, those are all the things in the world that you can use this money for, those are the only three that you can't use it for. So your request is denied. Well, they took this to court and said, well, wait a minute, these other organizations are getting money. The sustainable agriculture people are getting money. The healthy sexuality people are getting money. Why can't we get money for our religious programs? And the university kind of made the argument that they are going out of their way, kind of like using an overabundance of caution not to violate the Establishment Clause. That was kind of what their argument was. And no, the courts, both the lower court and the Court of Appeals, said no. An overabundance of caution to make sure that you don't violate the Establishment Clause is not a defense, and you have to provide this to all organizations on equal grounds. The university made the argument that the court didn't buy was that they felt they could discriminate based upon viewpoint, they felt that they could discriminate based upon content as opposed to discrimination based upon viewpoint. So they, you know, would have argued that, well, yes, we gave money to the sustainable agricultural people. If a non-sustainable agriculture group had come in and wanted money, yes, we would have given that money to them too, because we don't discriminate based upon viewpoint, either pro-sustainable agriculture or anti-sustainable agriculture. But the content can't be religious. And the court said, no, you can't discriminate based upon content when you're using funds like that. And they granted a declaratory judgment that the university is required to fund this particular project. Well, moving from the First Amendment to the Second Amendment. Now, if you're like me, a lot of you, when you were in law school, the Second Amendment was kind of a footnote in your constitutional law textbook. There really was not much jurisprudence on that. Because I think this is safe to say that, 20 years ago or even 10 years ago, advocacy groups like the NRA and other groups like that, I think, concentrated most of their efforts in the political arena, in state legislatures, in Congress, and had not really litigated very many issues. Well, that seems to be changing a lot. And the Second Amendment is getting litigated a lot more. Sometimes organizations like that, you know, you want to You want a compelling plaintiff, you want a sympathetic litigant in your case. They didn't get one in this case, unfortunately, but I think it's a kind of an important Second Amendment case. Here the defendant, frankly, was a pothead. He was this 18-year-old gentleman. He was arrested on some outstanding warrant. The court didn't say what the warrant was for, so probably something stupid, but he got arrested on this warrant. And when he was arrested, he had various things in his pocket. One of those items was a loaded pistol, and the other item was 0.7 grams of marijuana. Now, I don't know how much that is. I'm guessing 0.7 grams is a pretty small amount. So it was probably just a little bit for his daily enjoyment. He confessed, as the court said. One of those cases, he made his own. If he would have just shut up, he probably would have been fine. But when he was arrested, he said various things to the police that they took as a confession. And he, according to the court, he confessed that he had been smoking marijuana daily since age 16. The court also pointed out that he had been twice arrested for possession of marijuana. Now, they didn't say anything about convicted. They didn't say anything about whether this outstanding warrant had anything to do with that. He had been arrested twice for possession of marijuana, but no indication in the case that he was ever convicted of any drug charges or anything. Well, he's not the most sympathetic litigant in the world, and I suspect probably the world is a little bit better place that he's in the custody of the Bureau of Prisons for a couple of years. But he was charged and he was convicted of violating a statute, federal statute, which makes it a felony for someone who is, quote, an unlawful user of or addicted to any controlled substance to possess a gun. So the elements of that offense are you are addicted to or a habitual user, or unlawful user of an illegal drug. And you're in possession of a gun. That's it. It's not that you were previously adjudicated to be a drug addict or that you were previously convicted of a drug offense or something like that. What the charge is that you are an unlawful user of or addicted to any controlled substance. And he, the first thing the guy blurted out to the cops was, oh yeah, I smoke that every day. Well, and the gun was in his possession. So he was convicted of this.